take us through an analysis of what we've done so far, what's left to be done, and what the fiscal analysis is. It's going to be pricey, members, to conform with some of the major changes in federal law related to tax issues, including the extension of the Bush tax cuts, the Obamacare legislation, and the Small Business Jobs and Jobs Act. There are quite a few. So with that, Ms. Allen, if you would begin with an analysis of the tax conformity issues, and then we'll have a bigger discussion about tax conformity and what's been happening with that in the state of Minnesota and some of the things that we might want to look at on a bigger scale as opposed to the specific conformity issues that we're facing. So we'll start with the specifics, and then we'll have a broader discussion. Ms. Allen.
Madam Chair and members, in your packet there are two revenue estimates. One of them is dated January 28th, and those deal with the federal conformity bills that we have already discussed that were in both Senator Ortman's bill, Senate File 47, and Senator Roebling's bill, Senate File 60, which is currently on the Senate floor. So I'm not going to discuss those any further unless there are specific questions. Then also in your packet is another revenue estimate entitled Federal Update, the Tax Relief Unemployment Insurance Reauthorization and Job Creation Act. And that was the bill passed by Congress in December. And you can see the overall cost on the first page. And if you'll just turn in, to the second page, it's the start of all of the provisions. And we'll just go through those briefly. And if you have any questions, please let me know. The first cost item deals with repealing the limitation on itemized deductions. This is something from that was originally enacted in 2003 and was extended this year for two more years. This would take away the cap on itemized deductions and the phase out of personal exemptions. As you can see, that is a large cost item. The second item increases the standard deduction for married filers. What that deals with is what is the so-called marriage penalty, so that the standard deduction for joint married filers would equal twice that of individual filers. The education savings account, our Coverdell account contributions, and increases the amount that individuals are allowed to put into these education savings accounts. The next provision deals with employer-provided education assistance, and that allows up to $5,250 worth of employer-provided education assistance, and also extends the definition so that it's more than undergraduate degrees. For the student loan interest deduction, that changes the income phase out. So currently, without this change, the income phase out begins at $40,000 for individual filers and caps at $55,000 and $60,000 for joint filers, and $75,000 is where it caps out. And that would increase it to income levels at $55,000. That's where the phase out would begin for individual filers, and $110,000 for joint filers.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, can you back on the exclusion for employee-provided education assistance? Can you tell me or explain to me why it goes from why it doubles in 2012 and then it goes back down in 13?
Ms. Allen.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I think the department would probably best to talk about the dollars, but I would imagine it has to do with the lining up of the fiscal years versus the tax years. It's very common that because the taxable year is the calendar year and the fiscal year is half, that the first year is half the cost. So I have a feeling that's what the dollars is, but I would prefer for the department to speak on their numbers.
That's fine. Thanks.
Thank you.
Moving to the next page about exclusion for awards. Under the National Health Service Plan, normally these are taxable as taxable income. Any awards where someone is actually getting paid to teach or residency programs, and this would extend that provision.
Same thing.
I have a different version, but it's. For the dependent care credit, these are changes that would increase the expenses and the rate. Without the change, the limit is $2,400 for one child and $4,800 for two or more children. This would increase that cap to $3,000 and $6,000, and also change the percentage from 30 to 35 as to the expenses that could be deducted. The exclusion for adoption assistance is something we also talked about previously in the health care bills. This would allow up to $10,000 of an employer-provided assistance for adoption to be excluded from income. The next provision deals with bonus depreciation, and this is slightly different than what we saw in Senate File 60. This is not, the numbers on this estimate do not include full conformity. This is conformity to the extent that we already have in statute with the 80% add back. In Senate File 60, we had ongoing conformity starting in tax year 2011, and that's the same also for the Section 179 expensing below it.
Ms. Allen, can you just tell us what the difference in price is?
Madam Chair, I would leave that to the department to estimate, but I would imagine it's a much larger cost.
Thank you. I'll come back to it. Thank you.
Then dropping down to the suspension of net income limits, this deals with oil and natural gas properties. there's the deduction for educator expenses. In the past, Minnesota has not conformed to this provision, and it's currently an add back for the current tax year. The special rule for contributions of qualified conservation property, and then you have, once again, something that Minnesota has not conformed to with the qualified tuition and related expenses in the past. Then there are tax-free distributions to IRAs that increases the limits and the age level. There's a parity for exclusion for employer-provided mass transit and parking benefits. That's just so that where employers provide transit benefits, there would be the deduction would be allowed up to the same amount that they provide parking benefits. The following line item deals with depreciation for certain businesses, and that was extended for two more years. And a similar thing for businesses that are located on Indian reservations. There are enhanced charitable contributions for only C Corps that deal with food inventory and book inventory that allow them to take a higher value for their contribution, and the same for computers. There's an election to expense mine safety equipment. That is basically a 50% bonus depreciation for specific mine safety equipment. The following item deals with film and television production expensing and allowing them to do certain levels of bonus depreciation as well. There are some environmental remediation costs that allow for expensing in those areas. And payments to controlling organizations for unrelated business income tax. And then you get treatment of dividends for regulated investment companies. And then another item that we have that Minnesota has not conformed to in the past is the exemption under subpart F for active financing income that relates to certain business and financial sectors. You have the basis adjustment to S corporation stock for charitable contributions of property, and then an allowance to allow mortgage interest to be treated basically as qualified mortgage interest under that deduction. You see that the exclusion of gain on small business stock does not have a cost that's shown on this revenue estimate. And then two of the larger items deal with the working family credit, and the changes to the federal credit and the phase out would impact the way our credit is currently our credit is currently administered, and that would have to be picked up separately. And those are pretty much all the provisions from that act, Madam Chair.
Ms. Allen, Representatives of the department are here. Mr. Matt Mossman, a new assistant commissioner for the Department of Revenue, is here, and if you would join us. And Mark Peterson, an attorney for the Department of Revenue, is also here. Welcome to the committee, and Mr. Mossman, congratulations on your new position.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Matt Mossman, Assistant Commissioner for Tax Policy with the Department of Revenue, and I'm here with Mark Peterson from our Legal Services Division. I'm just going to make a few general comments about tax conformity with the federal tax changes, you know, that apply to kind of all of the bills, and then Mr. Peterson will be able to help add some details in terms of some of the complexities of not conforming or conforming to some of the provisions, and help answer any questions you have on understanding the provisions in the draft documents you have before you this morning. Just in general, as you all know, obviously, federal taxable income is the starting point for determining tax liability, and Minnesota's conformance to federal law is not automatic or assumed. We actually have to make those changes in our statutes to be in conformance for Minnesota taxing purposes. When we don't conform to changes in the federal definition of taxable income, or I should say doing so, certainly promotes simplicity, transparency, and tax compliance. If it's easier for taxpayers to complete their forms and understand how to determine their tax liability, it enhances compliance and enhances the accuracy and correctness of the forms being submitted. Not conforming, obviously, can result in more complicated instructions and computations for taxpayers, of which there's a range in terms of their abilities to do that on their own. It can increase the time that taxpayers need to complete their forms and the complications for tax preparer services. It can increase the costs, obviously, to taxpayers as a result of the software development and the additional costs of tax preparers to do it. So tax compliance from a simplicity and transparency standpoint is important. That said, of course, there are instances of either state, federal tax policy differences, and more recently, certainly, state budget constraints that have led to decisions to not conform on selected provisions or to partially conform or to find a way to conform with add-backs that reduces some of the complicating issues for taxpayers but still addresses or works within the constraints of the budget. And certainly some of those examples more recently have been the current law treatment of Section 179 expensing and bonus depreciation. In general, I would just, obviously, we have some provisions, a number of provisions this year. I think there's about 50 of them. And if you look at all the federal bills that are passed, there's provisions that affect tax year 2010. So, you know, as we move forward in session, there will be some relevance to talking about, taking action on those provisions that have the potential, obviously, to be challenging for taxpayers presently attempting to complete their income tax forms and submit them. We have, and I think you have in your packets, actually, we have on the department's website a form called the form, the M1NC. I think you have that. It looks like this, basically. The form M1C begins to give you a flavor of the challenge, what Minnesota taxpayers would have to, the changes that they would have to look at doing in order to file their Minnesota taxes if we do not conform on provisions that are on here for federal taxable year 2010. You can see Just to kind of highlight the front page of that form, you have items 1 through 10. And, of course, if you look at line 11, line 11 is actually just a reference to a number of other provisions that actually aren't cited on the front of this page but are in the instructions for this page. So the front page isn't don't receive that as that's the limit of the adjustments that taxpayers would have to make. And in this case, obviously, they would have to essentially for some of these provisions need to recompute their federal adjusted gross income just to complete their Minnesota tax form. So the complications are real. At the same time, there are a variability in some provisions that may be more or less straightforward to not conform to if that was the policy judgment of the administration and the legislature. But I'm going to pause at this point, invite Mr. Peterson to talk specifically and give you some examples about some of the provisions in this bill or the other bills just in terms of the range of conformity challenges.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. And picking up where Mr. Mosman left off, I mean, this M1NC. This M1NC includes virtually every, a reference to virtually every line in the sheet that Ms. Allen went through that has an effect for fiscal year 11 and fiscal year 10, plus changes that would have been in the other two bills that you heard, the other two federal bills that were included in the bill you heard last week. Those are all changes that were made that affect federal taxable income, which is the starting point for Minnesotans. What I'd like to do is highlight maybe three of these just to show you the kinds of complications that taxpayers have for 2010. One of them is the tax-free IRA distributions, up to $100,000 in minimum distributions for people 70 and a half who take an IRA contribution and they direct it directly to a charity. They don't get the money. They have it sent directly to the charity. Under the Internal Revenue Code, the provision that was extended here this year, taxpayers were allowed to exclude that income from that distribution from their adjusted gross income. They then weren't allowed to take a charitable deduction for that, you know, because that's okay, because they have no income, they have no deduction. If we don't conform, what that means is that these taxpayers have an adjustment to their income for this up to $100,000. It can be any amount. It doesn't have to be $100,000. This could be a $2,000 contribution to a church at Christmas time. It doesn't have to be $100,000. And then they'd have to recompute their itemized deductions for state purposes, or Minnesota has its own separate state charitable contribution deduction. They could make a modification to that. But this is one that only affects taxpayers over 70 and a half who are sending money directly to charity. So it's not just a matter of including this distribution as income. It's then Minnesota has to give some sort of separate treatment to be able to figure out what the deduction is. The next one is 15-year straight-line depreciation for leasehold restaurant and retail improvement and new restaurant properties. This is just symbolic of a whole slew of these where there's been a change in an appreciation schedule, change in amortization schedules. What this allows is for a 15-year write-off of improvements to leasehold and restaurant and retail property. In the absence of this provision, if we don't pick this up, Minnesota would, these taxpayers would have to keep records to do a 39-year depreciation, which would mean that Minnesota would have 39 years worth of modifications. That would be a burden on the taxpayers for sure. I think it would stretch our ability to be able to keep records for 39 years, quite frankly. And another one, the special expensing rules for film and TV productions. This is one that we looked at a little bit a couple years ago because this is a provision that's been extended a couple times. Under the laws that existed before we started on this with this provision was that if you had a small TV or film production with costs under $15 million, you could expense the costs immediately. if your production costs were over $15 million, you generally had to amortize those over the useful life of the asset. Difficult to tell what the useful life of a movie is, but with all the residual rights, it gets really hard. What this change was, it changed the definition of what an entity was. It used to be that a film was a film, and you couldn't split it up into U.S. rights, European rights, TV rights, first-run rights, CD rights. You couldn't do that. It was all considered one. Congress changed it so that you could have these separate entities were part of the same movie for $15 million. And then it was the first $15 million of expenses. So if you had a $100 million production, you could write off the $15 million. The problem is that for Minnesotans is that this wouldn't be, a lot of these wouldn't be Minnesota entities. It'd be individuals who would be investing in these. They'd be investing in out-of-state partnerships, out-of-state LLCs, and they would have to make a modification because the entity would be expensing these. They would have to figure out what the useful life of the asset was. They would have to figure out what the correct amortization would be of this asset. And as I was looking at this a few years ago, the IRS can't really figure this out. And I think the IRS was probably in favor of this provision because it made it a lot easier for a lot of taxpayers. But these Minnesota residents wouldn't have the assistance of even the partnership. The partnership doesn't care. They're not going to try to help them get the right answer. These individuals in Minnesota would have to be trying to figure it out. And I can tell you for certain, nobody at the Department of Revenue has the expertise to be able to start figuring out how to help. I mean, I'm sure we could develop the expertise if we had to, but we certainly don't have it now. And there's a number of other provisions that are similar to that and the complications. The provision dealing with REITs, for instance, deals with what kinds of income and what kinds of dividends the REITs can pay to some of their investors. If we don't pick that up, it gets to be a question of what does that mean? Have they paid out some dividends that they're not allowed to pay out for Minnesota purposes? Maybe that makes the distributions taxable in the hands of the REIT. I don't know, and I hope I never have to look at that because that would be a really complicated and unintended result. I mean, I could go on, but I mean, those are just three of the complications that are very real and are in effect for taxes the taxpayers owe for 2010. And it would be for 11 too, but right now the taxpayers are sort of in limbo because there's this uncertainty. I mean, the legislature and the governor have not rejected these proposals. So we're sort of in limbo on whether or not taxpayers should strictly follow the law. Should they assume that these provisions are going to be picked up and ignore our M1NC? Should they wait until the law is changed? And it's sort of a limbo for the taxpayers. That'll stop.
Mr. Mossman, you're uniquely qualified to talk to us about how the costs of conformity, if in a perfect world we could conform to everything federally, but there's a cost, and my understanding is the costs for conforming in this revenue were not included in our budget forecast, so it wouldn't be included in the deficit when you calculate that. Would you comment on that, about how this fits in to what our understanding is of the budget?
Sure, Madam Chair. And as I'm doing that, just one more follow-up to Mr. Peterson's comments. Just to kind of underscore, too, I think even for taxpayers who are not necessarily, if there are taxpayers who are not necessarily affected by any of these provisions, you would still be having taxpayers struggling with more complicated forms potentially to figure out if they have to be responsive to some of these provisions. So, you know, it gets complicated for everybody. With regard to the dollar amounts, I think if you look at all three bills together, I believe the three-year number for conforming to all provisions is about $303 million. So obviously, you know, in the budget constraints that we're in right now and the significant budget deficit of $6.2 billion, that is an additional, would be an additional challenge to conform fully. So, you know, I think that that is a judgment that will be weighed by the governor and presumably as well by the legislature as to whether or not there are ways that some of the provisions can be dealt with in a way that accommodates taxpayers from you know, minimizing the challenges of filing and conforming and making sure that they're filing the correct tax within the budget constraints. So, you know, certainly there's going to have to be some weighing of the individual provisions. I think that many of them are complicated for taxpayers and would certainly be ideal to conform to from a taxpayer simplicity and transparency standpoint. You know, I'm sure if that's answering your question. There are some that are more costly to conform to or have a larger budget impact than others. You know, I think there's probably a large number of provisions that actually represent a fairly small impact on the budget collectively.
Mr. Mossman, one of the things I've also learned is that Minnesota doesn't really do this the same way most states do this, that the conformity is adopted differently because at a different place in the process of the tax returns. Can either of you comment about that?
Madam Chair, I suspect it has to do that, and I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Peterson, but different states have different starting points for determining their state taxation, and I'm guessing that that has a fair amount to do with your question.
And Madam Chair, that's something to do with it, but I mean, I don't know what other I think some other states probably have some automatic pickup of the federal provisions or that they can later reject it, but Minnesota Supreme Court case in I think the early 1970s said that Minnesota would be an improper delegation to Congress to have things automatically picked up for as part of the Minnesota tax code, and as a result of that, those federal changes do not become part of Minnesota law unless and until Minnesota law is changed.
There was a chart in our packet this morning from the Department of Revenue. It's entitled Complexity Creep. Are either of you prepared to talk to us about this?
Madam Chair and members, I did get a glance at this yesterday for my first time. I think that, and I think you have a color-coded one in your packets, hopefully, because I, you know, certainly this is indicative in concept of the, you know, what we've been talking about just in terms of, you know, the transparency and the issues of taxpayer complications and simplicity that you want to take into consideration in terms of the federal conformity choices you have before you. But what I would also point out is that the red provisions on here are provisions that relate more so to circumstances in which we haven't or don't currently fully conform to federal law in terms of the definition of taxable income. But quite a number of these other provisions on here are provisions that have been state choices along the way that are not related really to decisions as to whether or not for budget reasons or other to conform to federal law. So certainly it is indicative and stark in terms of and educational in terms of where things were at in 87 compared to now. It definitely identifies some additional a number of additional forms or lines on the form and that need to be filled out by taxpayers.
Mr. Mossman or Mr. Peterson, I understand that you have you've measured the number, you have the number of taxpayers that will be impacted by our conforming or not conforming to the items in the spreadsheet that we received. Can we talk about those specific numbers of taxpayers affected? I I know Ms. Von Mosch has that same information. If we need to, we can refer to her and her expertise.
I did have it until just a minute ago, so maybe Ms. Von Mosch has it in front of her. But, yes, the department did yesterday put together some numbers, not really on all of the provisions necessarily, Madam Chair, but on some of the larger the provisions with that would have more Minnesotans affected, or returns, I should say. I can read through them and just identify. I think there's data on about six or seven provisions here. The repeal of the itemized deductions and phase out of personal exemptions, we believe, would affect about 114,000 returns. The federal changes in the standard deduction for married filers would affect about 506,000 returns. The change out in the student loan interest deduction would affect about 127,000 returns. Changes in dependent care credit definitions would affect about 27,500 returns. And then the changes in the working family credit would affect about a little under 41,500 returns. And then the educator expenses would affect a similar population, about 54,000 returns. And obviously some of these provisions are also, you know, some of the provisions that are, as we were talking earlier, you asking the budget question, Madam Chair, also some of the provisions that have some of the more significant impact on the budget if we were to fully conform as well.
Members, we can prepare these bills. A 2010 bill and a 2012-13 bill has been 11-12, excuse me, has been drafted. They've not been dropped in yet because this is very pricey, and I think I'm looking for consensus on the part of the committee on where we go with this, and I would appreciate any input or thoughts that members have about how do we do this. I'm not sure how we don't do it. I think Minnesota taxpayers should be given equal treatment as they would if they lived in Wisconsin or Iowa. These conformities will be extended to them, and we've talked about this with respect to some of the other conformities we've already passed through this committee. It's just a little breathtaking when you look at the fiscal note for it and what the impact is. Perhaps Senator Bach, you got a big old smile over there. Maybe you have a comment on that and some insight you'd like to share with the committee.
Madam Chair, I was visiting with Senator Rosen here about some of these small tax conformity provisions that we didn't conform to that actually over the years have been included in the Senate bill. And, of course, we have to raise money to pay for them. And then in conference committee, the governor was unwilling to allow us to do even some things that I viewed as compliance, things like the Amazon sales tax, digital downloads, some small pots of money to be able to do some of these. Like the IRA provision for people 70 and a half, I think that's a very good provision to allow those people to be able to give money tax-free to charity. And it's something the Senate has passed in the past. But, you know, Governor Plenty had a very bright line on what he considered a tax increase and was unwilling to let us raise revenue even to do conformity. So even though we tried in some of these areas, we weren't successful. But if this committee can raise some revenue and do some of this conformity, it's good policy.
Comments or questions from members about this?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Could I have an explanation? Going back to the handout, the federal update on tax relief, unemployment insurance, Job Creation Act of 2010. When we go to pages 2 and 3, take for example on page 2, the 100% bonus depreciation and 50% bonus depreciation. In fiscal year 2011, we have negative numbers, and in fiscal year 2012, we have positive numbers. I just need to understand. I came in just a few minutes late due to traffic, but could you explain to me what, or have someone explain to me what that means in the the transfer from negative numbers to positive numbers. And I see that also in the item below it, and also on the next page on the 15-year straight line depreciations and accelerated depreciation for business.
Mr. Peterson or Ms. Allen?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, can you just identify the lines for us again on this picture?
On pages 2 and 3, the last two items on page 2, where it says 100% bonus depreciation. Are you on the form federal update, the tax relief, unemployment insurance reauthorization, Job Creation Act 2010?
Senator Limmer, I think there were two versions. I got a little mixed up on this as well. We're looking at the one dated January 21 at the bottom of the first page.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one you're looking at. I'm not sure it's the same one that our testifiers have. Do you have the same version now, Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair and members, I believe that we do. You're looking at the revenue estimate. We were looking at the fiscal or the spreadsheet.
I think Senator Limmer's question relates to the fiscal analysis, the Department of Revenue. Ms. Allen?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, under the way this estimate is structured, we would retain the current add-back procedure where we have, and that's why you're seeing dollars come in, because it's an add-back. If it was full conformity, like in Senate File 60, you're going to see a cost. But the reason why you see the – and then you'll see out in fiscal year 2015 where there's the big cost, that's – when you do the add-back procedure, it pushes the cost out in fiscal years with all of these, and it's the same for Section 179 expensing.
Members, we also have with us today Carl Peterson from Peterson and Peterson from the CPA Society, and I know he's going to clear up all this complexity for us and give us some good direction about how to proceed under the circumstances.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bach.
Madam Chair, I haven't looked at Senate File 60. I'm just wondering what, I believe we're taking that up tomorrow, what conformity provisions are actually in that bill?
Senator Bach, I think Ms. Allen can comment on that. We picked up a few of the 2010 conformities, and we added them in this committee by amendment. And do you have those with you, Ms. Allen?
Madam Chair, Senator Bach, in that bill, as it stands, ready for the floor, the bills that are conformed to are the health care bills and the Small Business Jobs Act, so the bills through September, not this December bill. And in that bill includes provisions for Section 179 and bonus depreciation expensing for tax year 2010 with the add back, and then conforming fully in tax years 2011 and 2012.
And that's the extent of them?
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Senator Russ.
On that point, Ms. Allen, what is the fiscal impact of the provisions that are in Senate File 60 that have to do with federal conformity?
Ms. Allen? Ms. Von Mosch can answer that question. Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 60, which was the same as Senate File 82 as it passed out of this committee, has a cost in fiscal year 11 of $18,910,000. And in fiscal years 12 and 13, it's a cost of $3,920,000. And in fiscal years 14 and 15, it's $2,007,000 approximately. And so there is a relatively small cost in this biennium.
And
Senator
Madam Chair, Ms. Von Mosch, what, why the dramatic drop-off? What is that feature? Just
Ms. Von Mosch.
Refresh my memory, please.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, the primary reason for the drop-off relates to some of the items that, excuse me, that Ms. Allen referred to in terms of doing the full Section 179 expensing has higher costs in the early years because
full. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Von Mosch. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm probably going to echo many of the thoughts that the Department of Revenue has, and it's nice to see some familiar faces here. I've talked to many of you before. Now that you're aware that there's a number of items here, you know, the number and complexity of the issues has grown to where it is becoming an increasing cost of small business, not only in state income tax, but also in the cost of compliance. When I was asked to testify today, I was not sure from which perspective I would approach my comments. We could spend hours discussing the complexity of the nonconformity items. We could spend time also discussing the negative impact these items have on small business as they decide to expand or invest in capital assets. My comments will briefly cover some of the complexity and the impact of nonconformity has on small business, and perhaps the impact this has on the state of our economy as well. The bottom line is that the increasing complexity and the number of nonconformity items has a negative impact on job growth here in Minnesota. You can discuss the current income tax rates, and yes, it is great we are not number one in the nation, but when you consider the add-backs and adjustments for the nonconformity items, the effective state income tax rates are not as low as we would like to think. There are both complex items and just tedious little nonconformity items that increase the cost of doing business. For example, the administrative time for small business owners to add back to their W-2s the health insurance premium portion for their non-dependent children who are age 26 or younger, this time and cost adds up. While it seems trivial, it is time-consuming for business owners to gather the data and try and report it properly. Staff time for non-revenue activity does not promote business growth. I would also suggest that while this reporting requirement is well advertised and businesses have been notified, there are many businesses that are not in compliance and they want to do it right. The Minnesota instructions regarding nonconforming items identifies 24 common provisions that may affect a person's taxable income, but the real number is closer to 50. Let's look at perhaps one of the most talked about items that impacts small businesses, almost every business in the state of Minnesota, Section 179 deductions. While the maximum amount for federal purposes is currently $500,000, Minnesota is still limited to $25,000. Not much in capital equipment is that low for many of our manufacturing companies in Minnesota. Or even for a snow removal company, with the heavy snow this season, these companies are out buying trucks, and they cannot buy a truck for less than $50,000. For federal tax purposes, they can deduct 100% or $50,000 in 1 year, but only $25,000 in Minnesota. Then the business owner must track the tax basis, or they must pay their bookkeeper or pay their CPA to track the tax basis difference for Minnesota to ensure the small business ultimately gets the remaining cost as a deduction in future years. The cost to maintain the tax basis schedules adds to the tax burden put on by the state of Minnesota. This was a simple example. What about the businesses and restaurants that want to expand or improve, or a new business startup that needs new space? The federal law allows for Section 179 deductions on their leasehold improvements. What a great stimulus for economic growth. Construction jobs, materials purchased, sales tax paid, income tax to be paid by contractors doing the improvements. The benefits go on and on. But the state of Minnesota does not promote this economic stimulus through its nonconformity with Section 179. Yes, it is true that the small business owner is going to receive the full tax deduction over time, but they need to make their decision based on their cash flow today. The state of Minnesota would also receive its tax on the income from the small business over time, even if it allows the owner to deduct the same amount for Minnesota as they do for federal tax. I would suggest that conforming on this issue would increase capital expenditures that could boost the economy, create jobs, and pay for itself over time. Just to give you a clear example of the complex nature of this Section 179 area that relates directly to leasehold improvements, let me read to you line number 6 of the Minnesota Schedule M1NC, which you have in your packet, that all small business owners of an LLC or an S corporation must fill out. It says, enter the amount of any qualified leasehold improvement, restaurant, or retail improvement property included in the Section 179 property placed in service and reported on your actual Federal Form 4562, line 2. Do not include these properties on line 2 of your recomputed 4562 and recalculate the allowable depreciation based on prior law. Also, increase your net business income or decrease net business loss by this amount on your recomputed Schedule C or E 1040 for the business. Wow, that just raised the cost of tax preparation right there. The cost of compliance continues to grow. How can you expect small business owners to follow that logic and stay in compliance with Minnesota tax law? No wonder business owners are frustrated, and it would help to create a better business climate in Minnesota if we had conformity. These are only a few of the nonconformity items that directly impact small business, and there are many nonconformity items that impact employees. Things like the employer-provided adoption benefits, qualified deferral plan distributions rolled into a Roth account, these require the employee to recompute their 1040 for Minnesota purposes. Not only do you have to identify the difference on the Minnesota return, it requires that you recompute your 1040. Our software prints out a 1040 for federal filing purposes, and it also prints out another 1040 titled for Minnesota tax purposes only. It's difficult for professionals to stay on top of the complexity that nonconformity creates. It is likely that tax returns prepared by other individuals are not in compliance for these nonconformity items. When you consider the cost to have the auditors from the Department of Revenue conduct field audits, there can be considerable time spent addressing the nonconformity items. Unfortunately, the nonconformity items put a number of taxpayers out of compliance while they are trying to be honest and hardworking taxpaying people. Fixing the nonconformity items does have a cost, but there will be a cost savings by the reduced time field auditors take to address these issues. The training costs of Department of Revenue auditors would also be reduced. As stated earlier, conforming Section 179 and other items will make a difference to the small business owner, resulting in their expansion and capital investment, both which will result in jobs and a growing economy.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Did you see our chart on Minnesota's income tax calculation, the complexity creep that we were talking about?
I just saw it when you mentioned it. And, you know, it's amazing to be able to have this visual to me when, you know, as a tax professional and preparer, when you think about the complexity, it would be nice to have simplification, both at the federal and state level.
Well, Mr. Peterson, even if we were to adopt all of the conformities that were just passed with recent federal law changes, we still would have many that don't conform because of previous inaction on the part of the state.
Correct.
Can you comment on that a little bit?
Well, I think I think you have to start somewhere and start sometime. And I think the Section 179 is probably the biggest area and probably the biggest cost for small businesses. But if you don't start now, when are you going to take care of it, I guess?
Mr. Peterson, I'm on that specific line item on our analysis here. If we conform to the current law changes federally, would that bring us 100% in alignment with the federal, or is it only a partial conformity?
Say that one more time. If we did what?
If we conform as in our spreadsheet and in the fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, mm-hmm. is that 100% conformity? Or would there still be some remaining from previous years that we haven't conformed to, is my question.
Right. I think there would be, you have assets over the years in 2004 to 2008 that have been an add back in Minnesota. So those would not, I don't think, automatically come under conformity now. It would just probably be for items either if you went back to 2010 or 2011 going forward. We still have some carryover nonconformity issues to deal with for a period of time.
And Mr. Mossman, maybe you can comment. Is it still possible for us to go back and make changes to bring Minnesota to full conformity? Maybe Mr. Peterson is the right person.
Well, I would I think that'd be very difficult from this my perspective with the state and to have to change again and make changes to the forms and the activities that we've already been through with our small business owners going back to 2010 and making those changes, I think, would be very difficult and costly.
So going retroactive doesn't really help us here, but taking on the full conformity now with the current law changes makes sense.
That's just my own personal perspective.
Senator Rust?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could that be accomplished by allowing affected taxpayers just to file the amended returns to play the catch-up? I mean, it could happen.
It actually could happen.
It could happen mm-hmm. if a taxpayer wanted to, and we could allow amended returns for for those prior years if we adopted, just as a general practice, the conformity, we wouldn't, they wouldn't need to play catch up in the current year's return. They could go back and recalculate whatever our look back is for any general items, 3 years.
And the savings for the taxpayer would offset the cost of the return.
So it could happen.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Following up on Senator Rest's comments, what would be a reasonable or a realistic look back or a grab back if we did that?
Mr. Peterson.
It would make all of our lives easier if we went back to 2000, if we had let all the differential in the 179 that occurred from 2004 and 5 and 6, 7, 8, to let people capture those and not have that hang out going forward.
So going back to what year did I didn't
Senator
hear
Limmer.
That?
I probably didn't explain
Mr.
it very well.
Mr. Peterson.
If I understand your question right, how far back should we go to make that correction and allow that to happen? I would suggest that we allow, that we go back and allow any taxpayer who has prior Section 179 differential between federal and state to be able to pick up the balance of that amount and stop carrying forward those different tax basis schedules.
And
Mr. Peterson,
yeah, I just need to know how far would that be? Do you
Senator
know?
2004.
Senator
2004.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
That's not the current. What is the current look back period in terms of filing amended returns? How far back can you go?
It's 3 year.
3 years.
Senator Rest.
Would you? Excuse me. Thank you, Senator Orton. If for some reason, and this is probably all theoretical, but if we allowed a look back to 2004, it seems to me that we would also allow audits to go back that far as well. And there may be some reasons why individual or business taxpayers would not see that as a particularly good trade-off. And I'm not talking about fraud.
No, I'm
not talking about fraud, not criminal stuff, but just... But I think that would be the trade-off that the state would ask. If you're going to go back that far and file an amended return for 2004, then you're subject to audits for that as well.
Maybe I should clarify
Mr.
my
Peterson.
Thought process.
Okay.
My thought was when you were mentioning about amending, had to do more with, here we are in January or February now of the 2010 tax preparation season. My thought was if you're going to make something retroactive or make a change to allow them to pick up that basis differential, we have prepared many returns already. And because people have FAFSA forms for college education, a number of issues that they are dealing with. And so there's a push to get that done. So we've got a number of those done, and we'll have a number more done before any decision is made here in the legislature. My impression was that you were going to allow them maybe suggest amending the 2010 tax return. And my point is then that you could have a provision to allow in that amendment or, you know, when you make change for 2010 to allow for the catch-up. I would not amend prior to years to catch up that.
Okay.
I wouldn't fix it prior years. I'd fix it today and say you can amend and catch up that differential.
I see.
Well, and Mr. Peterson, what you're saying is you could go back and recapture all that depreciation from previous years on a 2010
amended return
if we acted legislatively and the governor agreed to allow us to go back in time and allow this credit looking back and the conformity looking back.
Yeah, because there are some items that will not have a differential any longer, even though they did, depending on their usable life. But there are a few items that are still out there that I'm sure people purchased that has that differential.
And to Mr. Peterson from the department, is there any way for the department to go back and estimate what kind of fiscal impact there would be to the state if we decided to do that kind of a
Madam Chair, I'm sure there is. As to this idea that it has happened in the past, I mean, there were some modifications for acres depreciation deductions. There were some modifications for previously taxed IRA contributions and previously taxed pension contributions. And at some point after those had been on the books for about 10 years, 15 years, a decision was made to let any other taxpayers that still had those modifications were still sitting out there to take them in the year that the law said they could take them. So there's some precedent for doing that, and I'm sure we could find numbers on that based on how much people have been claiming as modifications over the last 5 years on both the bonus depreciation and the 179 expensing.
Madam Chair.
Would the same be true for the bonus depreciation?
Madam Chair, I would think so. There's the add back and then the 5-year subtraction. So same principles would apply to both.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Peterson, or Mr. Peterson, the ones that you were referring to, sir, were in 1982, and then following the 1986 federal act that brought in the new depreciation schedule for acres. At the one time, Minnesota was facing a huge budget crisis in 82 with Governor Quay. In 86, or I suppose in the 87 session, was it just that the cost was too great, or were we facing a equally challenging fiscal situation?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, that goes back farther. I don't know the answer. I started with the department in 1987 when it was all as a taxpayer information person in the phone room, and it was really cool because it was about as easy as you could possibly have. There were no modifications in 1987, so I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. Just curious.
Yeah, I don't know the background. I was practicing at that time.
Yeah,
tell,
me too.
But, I was doing tax shelter projections, and then when the 1986 Tax Act came along, made a lot of changes. But I don't recall the background for the state of Minnesota.
Well, and looking at this chart on complexity creep, if I'm reading the chart correctly, the red items are the ones where we chose not to conform to federal law, and those that would be ripe if we were going to consider conforming retroactively would be in those groups of conformities. Or is that a complete list, Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, I believe it is.
It's a good list. I would mention that the first four items in red on there impact every small business in the state of Minnesota, especially every contractor deals with those issues. We deal with all those issues on their returns. And, of course, most of these red items are, then they all have college students, so they have, you know, other items that are adjustments as well. So.
And to Mr. Peterson from the department, is it possible for us to get even just a rough estimate at some point as to what it would cost for each of these outstanding conformity issues?
Madam Chair, I'm sure it is. I mean, a couple of them are, I think, have gone away simply because of the code was not updated to include the deduction for the real estate taxes or motor vehicle taxes. And the unemployment compensation exemption wasn't renewed either, but for the others, sure.
I think that'd be very interesting, members, for us to look at that. If we're going to look at federal conformity, let's look at federal conformity. Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, I would agree. If our vision and goal is to simplify our tax code long term and make the state more business friendly to compete nationwide, then we must accept this. Not accepting it is a de facto tax increase. It will be, I believe, stimulative. And it would be a tax increase on everybody, I believe. And I believe there are, as Senator Bach mentioned, probably some other compliance issues and ideas out there that could be done to make up for a lot of this. You know, compliance issues and not tax increases. So, as difficult as it might seem, I would think it would be a great idea, actually. You know, many of us, having worked in business and worked on these forms and these returns, can speak personally to the complexity and difficulty of it. I do recall the simple years of doing returns. So that's my opinion. We should go in and take it and go even further, as you had suggested, and others, is maybe go back and allow conformity back to prior years. Thank you.
I think we've gotten to that place where Senator Bach has suggested there may be some push and pull between the Tax Committee and the Finance Committee and the spending and what really costs us to do conformities and where do we come up with the funds to pay for the conformity. But I think we have good champions in the Tax Committee for tax reform. So I'm hoping that we're making the case here this morning that this makes an awful lot of sense, not only to make the conformities for the current law changes, but to go back and estimate how much it would cost to clean this up and do full conformity, even looking back. Are there comments or questions from the committee or from our testifiers? We're finishing early today. I appreciate the work of the committee very much. And to Mr. Mossman, Mr. Peterson, and Mr. Peterson, Ms. Ellen, thank you very much. Tomorrow, members, we have a joint hearing with the Finance Committee. We will be looking at how Minnesota compares to other states in terms of our taxes paid and also with our budget. I also want to point out that there's also been a lot of work that's been done even since yesterday's hearing on some of the questions we had on property taxes. And so you'll see in your packet a memo from Ms. Cadoon, our committee administrator, and thank you for that, Ms. Cadoon. She has identified the questions that came up from yesterday's hearing, and she has gathered information mostly from Mr. Nord, if you remember, he testified yesterday about some of the questions that came up and providing us answers to some of those questions. So Senator Howe, Senator Scoy, and I all asked questions. We've got some follow-up information in our packets.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
Just an added comment about the conformity. What would be also interesting and probably still very theoretical would be to take what it would take to cost to do full conformity and at the same time get rid of all the additional credits, checkoffs, subtractions that Minnesota puts on top of that conformity. And what if we just did pure conformity and all you had to do was put the number in and then apply a tax rate, but you didn't get a subtraction for this, you didn't get a subtraction for that, you know, we didn't do differently on the working family credit, we didn't do differently on the education subtraction, and to, you know, have a balance of what it would actually mean to just totally simplify our system without all the additional bells and whistles that Minnesota has added as a choice between those bells and whistles, even, and I support many of them, as opposed to the trade-off with federal conformity. And I think over the years, those were some of the decisions that were made. It was a trade-off to have a different kind of working family credit as opposed to the earned income, the federal earned income credit, and other things as well. And I think that's got to be part of the discussion as well as a policy position for the legislature.
Senator Rest, I think that's a great point. If we're talking about simplicity, let's talk about simplicity. And that comes at different levels in the tax preparation. And so I appreciate that comment. I think we should look at that. So with no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.